I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. 9/11 was the pivotal false flag event that put us on the war trajectory in the Middle East. Today you're going to hear the second and final part of a recent interview by Bonnie Faulkner of KPFA Radio out of Berkeley, California, with Canadian economist and founder of the website globalresearch.ca, Michelle Chusadovsky. They're discussing the situation in the Middle East. So let's get started with the second part of that interview.
And why is a war against Iran not in Israel's best interest?
Well, that's a very important question. We might recall that a few years back, there was a controversy regarding a statement allegedly made by President Ahmadinejad to the effect that Israel should be wiped off the map. And in fact, that statement was never made. It was a fabrication of the U.S. media. And what Ahmadinejad had actually said was that history will tell us that Israel will be removed from the page of history. There have been translations and analysis of that statement, but never did he actually point to any action by Iran to destroy the state of Israel, but simply saying that the regime in Israel will become obsolete. It will no longer exist historically, namely pointing to the Zionist entity. And that statement, in effect, was used by U.S. foreign policymakers not only to create an aura of panic within Israel, but also to build a casus belli directed against Iran, a thematic justification that because the Iranians wanted Israel to be wiped off the map, we should come to the rescue of Israel and we should wage a preemptive war against Iran so that that would prevent them from doing what they had said they wanted to do, which is to wipe Israel off the map. All of which points to the falsehoods of the Western media, which portray Israel as the victim and which portrays Iran as the threat to global security, not only to the security of Israel, but to the security of the Western world, when in fact, if we look at the facts, we can see that the major threat to global security is the United States and NATO, which are waging war simultaneously in different regions of the world. Now, is this war on Iran in the interest of Israel? Is this war there to prevent Iran from attacking Israel? The answer to that question is no. That war will ultimately unleash a response by Iran. Iran has no interest in attacking Israel if Israel doesn't attack Iran. But in the case where the United States and Israel wage aerial bombardments directed against Iran, Iran will retaliate. And that act of retaliation is known and understood by U.S. military planners who are prepared to designate Israel as a collateral damage. The people of Israel are the collateral damage of U.S. foreign policy, of U.S. war plans. Because if any kind of military action is unleashed against Iran, there will be retaliation against targets in the Middle East, including Israel. So that, in effect, who is wiping Israel off the map? It's President Obama. It's not President Ahmadinejad, because President Obama has ordered an attack on a country which has the right to defend itself, and it will defend itself in the form of retaliation against those who have attacked it, namely Israel and the United States.
What is Austere Challenge 12?
The United States and Israel are currently involved in what is described as the most advanced and the largest war games in Israeli history. And these war games, entitled Austere 12, are there essentially to test Israeli air defense systems in the case of a war directed against Iran. The framework of these war games and the timing is crucial because in the last few months, Iran has been conducting war games. In fact, it completed a set of war games in late December, and the United States and Israel are now planning to wage their own war games. These war games also serve as a show of force to Iran. They're there to intimidate their enemy and to indicate that the United States and its allies are prepared to wage war on Iran if certain conditions are not met.
What is Theater Iran near-term war planning termed T-I-R-A-N-N-T, or tyrant?
Since 2003, the United States has been involved in war preparations directed against Iran. And in fact, it has also conducted a number of war scenarios or war games. And Theater Iran near term was one of the first war games conducted in the immediate wake of the war on Iraq. It was conducted, in fact, in May of 2003, barely 1 month after the completion of theater operations by the U.S. military in Iraq. Now, Theater Iran near term are war games and simulations which are based on this notion of global strike, Concept Plan A022, which consists in actual plans of the Navy, the Air Force, which are then translated into strike packages against a specified enemy. Theater Iran near term essentially replicated the Blitzkrieg, the shock and awe bombing campaign, which commenced in March of 2003, directed against Iraq, and it at least confirmed the fact that the U.S. military had already identified several thousand targets inside Iran as part of this military agenda. The notion that the United States would be conducting limited strikes or surgical strikes has to be questioned because the war games that they've conducted invariably involve a much broader air campaign, which inevitably could also evolve towards a ground war. Now, a few years later, in 2006, the Pentagon launched another set of simulations under what was called Vigilant Shield. And these exercises are of particular interest because they essentially build a scenario of global warfare. The war simulations are not limited to a single Middle East war theater, as in the case of Tyrant. They also include Russia, China, and North Korea. And it's interesting to point out that in these war games, you never identify the country by its actual name, so that the names of the enemies of America under Vigilant Shield are Ermingham, Iran, Nemazi, North Korea, Rubek, Russia, and Shuria, China. And essentially, Vigilant Shield is a scenario for World War III because it shows how actions by Iran, missile testing and so on, are then followed by actions by Rubek and Shuria, Russia and China, and that there's a whole sequence of events. Essentially, in Vigilant Shield, the United States of America is the object of a military operation by this alliance of rogue states, And, of course, also the war games are there to build a consensus among top decision makers that the threat is real and that Shoria, Rubek, Irmingham, and Nemesi are the enemies of America and are threatening America. And this is the framework which is presented under Vigilant Shield.
And what is the road to conflict provision in Vigilant Shield 07?
It's interesting to point out that in the details and sequencing of Vigilant Shield, where Irmingham, Nemesis, Rubek, and Shoria are identified, there's a so-called road to conflict. And it starts when Irmingham starts nuclear enrichment, and then when Rubek and Irmingham are involved in military cooperation, and then it evolves towards a situation where Rubek closes its U.S. embassy in Washington, and then the Rubeki Russian president makes a statement on a possible U.S. attack, but in fact what happens is that Rubek attacks the United States, and then there's a media campaign which discredits the Russian, the Rubek president, and so on. This set of simulations has all different aspects, you know, of diplomatic interaction, warfare, and so on. And we should understand that most of simulations and war games are not made public. And these two war games stand out because we have limited information on their features and characteristics, but there have been lots of other war games conducted by the U.S. military which are more sophisticated, more advanced, and which have not been released to the public domain. But I'm certainly convinced by my understanding of military planning that there is a global military agenda. There's a sequencing of military operations, yet if you look at the project for the new American century, they clearly specify that military operations are not necessarily to be conducted consecutively, and that the United States is involved or should be involved in major theater operations in different parts of the world simultaneously. So that there is sequencing, but there's also this notion of waging simultaneous actions in different parts of the world. And that is the situation which ultimately prevails today. We see the U.S. military involved in the Middle East and Central Asia, but they're also involved in the Horn of Africa, in Somalia in particular, in southern Sudan. They have various covert operations in different parts of the world. They're threatening China. They're threatening Russia. So that we are within the framework of global warfare.
Now, do the Vigilant Shield 07 war simulations also function as internal propaganda with a view to developing a preemptive war consensus within U.S. elites? You write about this.
Well, the United States and its allies have conducted over the years what they call top-off exercises. Top-off exercises, in fact, were conducted under the auspices of Homeland Security, and they were addressed to top officials, as the code of the games indicates. But these top-off exercises were, in effect, geared towards preventing acts of terrorism in the United States. So it was within the realm of the war on terrorism. But more broadly, war games are also there to convince top decision makers in the military, in law enforcement, in civilian government, that the enemy is real, that there's a threat. I think that war games generally serve several purposes. They certainly feed the decision-making process of actual military planning. But there's another very important function. They're there to create a consensus at the top levels of the military, but also within the realm of civilian politics, of top decision makers within America, that the war is justified, that the threat is real, that the enemies want to attack America, that we have to defend ourselves, because ultimately they build scenarios where the United States is defending itself against a known enemy. And in the case of Vigilant Shield 07, it's Russia and China and Iran and North Korea, which are the rogue states, which are attacking America, and they constitute members of the Axis of Evil, and we have to defend ourselves, and so on and so forth. So that these simulations are ultimately, the simulations are there to convince the participants that the threat is real and that America needs to defend itself, and therefore preemptive warfare is a valid objective of U.S. military doctrine.
How likely do you think a war pretext or provocation incident is, or a false flag type scenario?
Well, at the present juncture, there's a massive buildup of U.S. military might in the Middle East, with the transfer of 9,000 troops to Israel, 15,000 troops to Kuwait, the deployment of aircraft carriers in the Arabian Sea, the war games which are planned both by the United States and Iran, to the extent that an incident in the Persian Gulf, in the Strait of Hormuz, could lead to confrontation at a military level between Iran and U.S. allied forces. Whether this confrontation would be actually triggered by the United States and that Iran would fire the first shot, that remains to be established. But if we look at U.S. history, we know that from the Spanish-American War onwards, this has been the strategy of the U.S. military. There's a continuum in U.S. military history. A casus belli, a cause for war, has always been sought with a view to establishing public support for the war. And we might ask ourselves, is the Obama administration prepared to sacrifice one or more vessels of the Fifth Fleet, which is stationed in Bahrain, which would result in extensive casualties among soldiers and sailors? And this would be implemented with a view to mustering public support for a war in Iran on the grounds of self-defense. Bearing in mind the history of war justifications, this is something which could be envisaged by military planners. There's certainly acts of provocation which are occurring at this very moment with these war games.
Well, now, there have been a series of economic sanctions put on Iran, and there's a new set in the works. Now, how are these sanctions against Iran affecting Iran generally? There are sanctions against the Iranian Central Bank now, isn't there?
Yes, let me first say that these sanctions directed against Iran are predicated on the fact that Iran has a nuclear weapons program. And the irony is that coinciding with the implementation of those sanctions, which was on the 31st of December, when President Obama actually approved the sanctions regime, Leon Panetta, the U.S. Defense Secretary, went live on network television and stated unequivocally, I quote, "Are they trying to develop a nuclear weapon? No," unquote. In other words, the U.S. Secretary of Defense has, in effect, told us that the pretext for imposing the sanctions is invalid, and this has also had an impact on the way U.S. allies have responded to the sanctions regime. Yes, the U.S. sanction regime on the Iranian Central Bank have been devastating. They've led to a massive collapse in the Iranian rial, the Iranian currency. Yet, with regard to Iran's oil exports, both Russia and China have refused to abide by these sanctions. But these are sanctions imposed by the U.S. administration and the U.S. Congress. They're not sanctions which are imposed by the United Nations Security Council. So China has said no, and very categorically, and the Russians have said the same. And in fact, the Russians have even stated that they will stand by Iran militarily if Iran is attacked. With regard to the oil exports, China relies heavily on Iran. In fact, 22% of China's oil requirements are in the form of imports from Iran. So that is a very significant amount of oil. And consequently, I don't see that Iran will necessarily that its oil industry will be paralyzed as a result of these sanctions, because both Russia and China have emphasized that they will not enforce the sanctions regime. And I would suspect that while the Europeans have paid lip service to the sanctions regime, in effect, there will be a number of loopholes. And at least from that standpoint, the Iranian oil industry stands firm in relation to Western threats.
And what do you think of the Iranian threat to close the Strait of Hormuz and the back and forth with regard to these threats?
Well, that is, of course, a very complex question. I think it's important to understand that the Strait of Hormuz is a very narrow canal passageway between the Gulf of Oman and the Persian Gulf. And it is very difficult for U.S. warships or for general cargo vessels to transit through the Strait of Hormuz without going through Iranian territorial waters. Now, to this effect, in recent developments, the Iranian parliament has been re-evaluating the use of Iranian waters at the Strait of Hormuz by foreign vessels. And in fact, they've passed legislation, or they're passing legislation, which would block foreign warships from going through Iranian territorial waters without seeking the permission of the Iranian authorities. That is what is at stake, because at this juncture, it is very difficult to transit through that narrow passageway without either entering into Iranian territorial waters or on the way out through the territorial waters of Oman. It's a passageway of, in terms of width and number of islands there, which is less than 100 kilometers wide.
And finally, Michel, what is the responsibility to protect?
The responsibility to protect is part of this humanitarian mandate. It's a fabricated concept. It states that NATO has the responsibility to protect the populations of countries which have authoritarian governments or where democracy does not prevail as it prevails in Western countries. And so that responsibility to protect means that you can go into a country, bomb the hell out of the country with a view to instating democracy. And this was the logic of NATO's intervention in Yugoslavia in 1999. It was also the logic underlying the intervention in Libya last year, 2011, to the fact that you intervene with the support of the United Nations Security Council with a view to protecting people in that country, protecting Libyans against their own government. But in effect, that whole notion was based on lies and fabrications, particularly with regard to Libya, where the country was literally destroyed. Its infrastructure was destroyed, its water system, its food distribution system, its institutions, its schools and universities were bombed, healthcare centers were bombed. None of this was really reported in the media, except with regard to a minimal coverage on so-called collateral damage. We didn't mention the fact that the so-called rebels were integrated by Al-Qaeda-affiliated organizations, the Libya Islamic Fighting Group. They were the foot soldiers of NATO. They were supported by U.S. intelligence operatives on the ground. And in fact, that this was a NATO invasion of a sovereign country. Whether we like the leader of that country or not is not the issue. And for many years, the war in Iran has been on the Pentagon's drawing board. Oil is the trophy of this war on Iran. In other words, what the United States and its allies wants to do is to break up the Iranian oil industry, reprivatize it, and hand it over to the United States and British oil companies. We must understand that the Anglo-Persian oil empire was a British project of what is now called British Petroleum, previously called the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, and that the oil wealth in Iran was, in fact, the very basis for the development of British Petroleum as one of the largest world's corporations in the oil business so that what the United States and its allies want, it's an Anglo-American project, is to reconquer those oil reserves and confiscate the assets of the Iranian oil industry. That is the unspoken objective of this war, and the U.S. media is misleading us into believing that somehow we are waging this war to protect Israel from Iran and to make the world safer by going after Iran and its allies. And I should also mention that both Russia and China are fully aware of the fact that the war on Iran is ultimately the stepping stone to a broader war directed against the two remaining competing powers in the world, namely Russia and China. And it's not by accident that in the latest allocations of the U.S. defense budget, that much emphasis has been placed on the militarization of the Pacific and the South China Sea. Why? Because essentially that is where the U.S. military wants to place its forces for the future, challenging, of course, the growing role of China in the Asia-Pacific region.
Michel Chosadovsky, thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be on the program.
And again, you've just been listening to the second part of an interview between Bonnie Faulkner of KPFA and Michel Chosadovsky of globalresearch.ca. And now I'm going to read parts of an article that were posted on globalresearch.ca on February 20th, 2012, called Silencing the Critics by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts. It's a long article, and I'd encourage you to check it out, but I'm going to just read you parts of it. So here goes. Last week, in one fell swoop, the last two remaining critics of the Washington-Tel Aviv imperialism were removed from the mainstream media. Judge Napolitano's popular program Freedom Watch was canceled by Fox TV, and Pat Buchanan was fired by MSNBC. Both pundits had wide followings and were appreciated for speaking frankly. Many suspect that the Israel lobby used its clout with TV advertisers to silence critics of the Israeli government's efforts to lead Washington to war with Iran. Regardless, the point before us is that the voice of the mainstream media is now uniform. Americans hear one voice, one message, and the message is propaganda. The Western media demonizes those at whom Washington points a finger. The lies pour forth to justify Washington's naked aggression. The Taliban are conflated with Al-Qaeda. Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction. Gaddafi is a terrorist, and even worse, fortified his troops with Viagra in order to commit mass rape against Libyan women. President Obama and members of Congress, along with Tel Aviv, continue to assert that Iran is making a nuclear weapon, despite public contradiction by the U.S. Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, and the CIA's National Intelligence Estimate. According to news reports, Pentagon Chief Leon Panetta told members of the House of Representatives on February 16th that, quote, Tehran has not made a decision to proceed with developing a nuclear weapon, unquote. However, in Washington, facts don't count. Only the material interests of powerful interest groups matter. As a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, Iran has the right to develop nuclear energy. IAEA inspectors are permanently in Iran and report no diversion of nuclear material to a weapons program. In other words, according to reports of the International Atomic Energy Agency, the U.S. National Intelligence Estimate, and the current Secretary of Defense, there's no evidence that Iran has nukes or is making nukes. Yet, Obama has placed illegal sanctions on Iran and continues to threaten Iran with military attack on the basis of an accusation that is contradicted by all known evidence. The problem that truth faces is that the Western media continually lies. On the rare instances when the lies are corrected, it is always long after the event, and therefore the crimes enabled by the media have been accomplished. The U.S. has no independent print and TV media. It has prostitutes who are paid for the lies that they tell. The U.S. government, in its pursuit of its immoral aims, has attained the status of the most corrupt government in human history. Yet Obama speaks as if Washington is the font of human morality. The U.S. government does not represent Americans. It represents a few special interests and a foreign power. U.S. citizens simply don't count, and certainly Afghans, Iraqis, Libyans, Somalians, Yemenis, and Pakistanis don't count. Washington regards truth, justice, and mercy as laughable values. Money, power, hegemony are all that count for Washington, the city upon the hill, the light unto nations, the example of the world. And again, that was from Paul Craig Roberts' article, Silencing the Critics. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.